Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's December the 29th, 2020. This podcast is the third one in the series, Reason on Reason, in which I've been considering the question, what is reason? I'll start with a brief recap of the first two episodes. The first one was concerned with giving a map of the territory that I wanted to cover. I make the point in that one that this question, what is reason, isn't that straightforward. Consequently, I decide to take a broad brush to many aspects of this question, including the historical dimension, the matters of logic, argument and hermeneutics, the matter of madness or the absence of reason, and the matter of the possible uses of unreason. The second episode dealt with the historical dimension, and particularly with the precursors to the so-called European Enlightenment, or the Age of Reason, which characterised itself as an age in which reason came to the forefront of life and was finding uses in many, many aspects of life, and which was accompanied by a great optimism and feeling of possibilities for the future and of rapid development in many, many spheres of life. That episode focused on the scientific revolution, the realisation that evidence was important, and the realisation that physics could be mathematised, and that general laws of the behaviour of the natural world could be arrived at through this mathematical approach. You get the rise of experimentation also, and all of this is coupled with a kind of scepticism, a willingness to question. Willingness to question nature, but also to question the nature of humanity and also to question the nature of society. So that episode focused in on Isaac Newton, Copernicus, Galileo and so forth. I also make the point that there was a pragmatic concern behind this rise of science and the widespread application of this new mechanics to industry and to production, and the rapid development of the economy along industrial lines. So it's the beginnings of the industrial revolution based on a scientific revolution. In this episode, I'm going to focus in on that sceptical tendency, or that questioning tendency that I just mentioned. And I will mention a few cases of the way in which this tendency was manifest. I'm particularly going to give some attention to a newspaper article that was written in 1784 by Immanuel Kant, called Answer to the Question, What is Enlightening? Skepticism, then. The first sceptic I want to mention is David Hume. David Hume was what we call a Pyrrhonian sceptic. This means that, like Pyrrhonius, his scepticism was very far-reaching. He tried to apply it to everything. In line with this, Hume, of course, was an atheist, which was quite rare in those days, but certainly some aspects of organised religion had taken a retreat. Prominent intellectuals and scientists were often deists, so they weren't exactly Christians. There was some pushing back of the authority of the Catholic Church in Catholic Europe also. The divine right of kings had taken a dive in England in 1688 with the rise of parliamentary power. But Hume took all this one step further and was a professing atheist. This caused him certain career difficulties. Hume was an extremely able philosopher, a great philosopher, but was refused the chair at Glasgow because he was an atheist. So there was still religious intolerance around at the time. Now, as I say, the God idea had taken a step back. For deists, God was the retired architect or watchmaker of the universe who didn't intervene. And I say Hume was able to press his scepticism right into believing in the non-existence of God. An interesting sceptical paper by Hume, which is a fairly easy read, is a paper on miracles, in which Hume takes the piss out of people who believe in miracles. He's very careful with his language. He uses a kind of double irony so that he's got plausible deniability should he fall foul of ecclesiastic authority. Hume's also sceptical about causality and the notion that the whole universe is governed by cause and effect. He said you can't actually prove cause and effect. We have to assume it. But really, he asks us, is it anything more than a habit of thought? It was this line of reasoning and questioning and scepticism that galvanised Kant into writing his three critiques. Another sceptic I want to mention is Voltaire. And Voltaire was actually sceptical, I would say, of grand philosophical systems, such as that elaborated by Leibniz. Leibniz had attempted a metaphysical a theory of all and everything, of an outcome of this grand systematizing was the belief on the part of Leibniz that this world is the best of all possible worlds and everything's somehow great. And this is famously ridiculed by Voltaire in his short novel Candide, which I heartily recommend, in which this optimism that this is the best of all possible worlds is brought up against the brutality and facticity of human life itself. And it's very well worth a read, and it's very instructive in many ways. And it does instill in many people a scepticism about grand theorising of huge metaphysical systems. This, of course, plays into science of an experimental kind, in that one would want evidence for grand assertions, and evidence for grand assertions is rather more difficult to obtain than evidence for sort of fairly modest assertions, at least in the beginnings. Now to the meaty business of Kant's 1784 newspaper article, Was ist Aufklärung, or What is Enlightening, or more fully, Answer to the question, What is Enlightening? I should mention that I will be using an 18th century translation of Kant's article. I think it was translated in 1798-99 by William Richardson. So it was it took a bit of a time to get to an English audience. A little bit about Immanuel Kant first. Kant is regarded by many people as one of the greatest philosophers in the Western tradition to have ever lived. And even if you don't agree with that, you have to take heed of the man's huge influence. Kant wrote three masterworks, The Critique of Pure Reason, The Critique of Practical Reason, and The Critique of Judgment. These works are still in print and still widely studied. As interesting as those works are, and as typical as they are of the age in which they were written, in the age of enlightenment, I'm actually going to focus on a humble newspaper article written by Kant to praise the Age of Enlightenment's self-characterisation as an Age of Enlightenment, as an Age of Reason, and what that entails. Kant is doing a kind of a self-reflection on behalf of the collectivity of, I suppose you might say, thinking people across Europe in the 18th century. Kant cuts to the chase with his very first paragraph. I'll read it and then I'll clarify it a little bit because the language is a little archaic. Here we go. Enlightening is man's quitting the nonage occasioned by himself. Nonage, or minority, is the inability of making use of one's own understanding without the guidance of another. This nonage is occasioned by oneself, when the cause of it is not from want of understanding, but of resolution and courage to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another. Sapere aude. Have courage to make use of thine own understanding is therefore the dictum of enlightening. Okay, we need to sort of clear up some of the funny language here. Enlightening means, enlightenment means being able to use reason. And nonage is a funny word here, you know. Enlightenment is man's quitting the nonage occasioned by himself. Nonage is an 18th century term meaning minority, being in your age of minority. So Kant is characterising the Enlightenment as an era in which people are becoming mature and confident enough to use their own reason rather than expecting to be told what to believe and what to think and how to understand by authorities, external authorities. That's what sapere aude means. It means have the courage to know or to understand. Kant goes on to make the point that liberty is a requirement if people are going to cast off their nonage or their immaturity or their legal minority and become free thinkers and thinkers for themselves. Here's the quotation. To this enlightening, however, nothing is required but liberty. And indeed, the most harmless of all that may be named liberty. To wit, that to make a public use of one's reason in every point. But I hear exclaim from all sides, don't reason. The officer says, don't reason, but exercise. The financier, don't reason, but pay. The clergyman, don't reason, but believe. Here is everywhere restriction of liberty. So far, so revolutionary. But, as you read on, you find that Kant is a little uneasy or certainly willing to point out a tension between the idea that a population should be allowed to think what it likes on whatever subject it likes and the possibility that such free thinking en masse could lead to some social unrest or some breakdown in the authority of the government, or in the case in which, or in the case about which Kant is talking, the authority of the King of Prussia, Frederick the Great, the so-called enlightened despot. After all, if authority can be questioned, and Kant is here recommending the questioning of authority so that we may grow up as individuals and be mature, then the authority of a monarch could be questioned. So how does Kant deal with this tension between the requirements of liberty if free thought is to obtain, if people are to think for themselves rather than be subservient to authority, at the same time as social order is maintained? And Kant's answer, I think, may be a cop-out. Kant's take on this is to say that more or less what Frederick said to Prussian citizens, I'll quote, "Reason as much as you please, and in what you please, but obey." This means that an Enlightenment society, as far as Kant is concerned, is one in which there is free thought. One can think what one likes, one can believe what one likes. There is freedom of religion. We can appreciate whatever art we like. But if we do have public office, if we are functionaries of the state, or if our place in society requires us to work for the status quo, that we obey, we follow the chain of command, we do as the emperor says, or as the prince says. So for Kant, the project of allowing free thought, enlightenment, thinking for oneself, to pass through a society and become the modus operandi of the citizens of a particular society, an enlightened society, the matter must be gradual in order not to compromise the functioning of the state, and in order not to incite functionaries to do as they please. So Kant does want to change society, but he sees that this is only going to be accomplished gradually. On the matter of revolution, Kant has this to say. "A nation can attain enlightening but slowly. A deliverance from personal despotism and interested and tyrannical oppression may perhaps be obtained by a revolution, but never a true reform of the cast of mind. New prejudices will serve, just as well as the old, for leading strings to the thoughtless multitude." And this is quite a kind of familiar trope, I think, and you hear this applied by opponents of the idea of revolution to this very day. Now, it's interesting that, okay, Kant was writing in the 1784, well, in 1776, so not that long prior, that the American colonies had cast off the yoke of the English crown and declared themselves independent. And a few years later than that, in the 1780s, had written the Constitution, which is a thoroughly Enlightenment document in the realm of politics. Now, quite a bit of inspiration was found by the early colonists, certainly the intellectuals and lawyers amongst them, in the works of John Locke of the previous century. And Locke had done a couple of things, one of which was to attempt to be what he called Newton's underlabourer. In other words, Locke was a philosopher who attempted to solidify empiricism, or the notion that the evidence of the senses is what allows us to arrive at truth. And of course, right in there is a kind of a basis or a foundation, or an attempt at a foundation for empirical science, for experimental science that relies on observation. So Locke's quite a kind of a pivotal figure. But Locke also inspired in his political thought the foundation of America with his notion of rights. And I suppose here there's a scepticism operating on Locke's part about the social formations of feudalism and monarchy and so forth. And which deprives people of rights. They are merely chattels or serfs with very few rights. And Locke wanted to ground these basic ideas, what he called life, liberty, and property. And this, under the American guise, this became life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness actually means the right to hold property and to develop the property and invest one's capital and so forth. So there's a kind of a foundational moment with Locke, not only in the empirical experimental science of Newton, but also the politics, which was dubious about feudalism and the rights of kings, and the rights to tax people without any kind of representation, which formed the basis of the American Revolution of 1776. And of course, Kant must have been aware of this, and there is this kind of like tension between the desire for liberty and the free thought that liberty would guarantee to citizens on the one hand, and that the possibility that this might lead to some kind of revolution or some subversive events which would counter the status quo. Now, it wasn't long after Kant was writing this piece, in fact in 1789, of course, was the French Revolution. And the scepticism behind that was the notion that the kings were appointed by God, the divine right of kings, was doubted. There was scepticism about the right of the aristocracy to purloin most of the wealth of the nation. To conclude, then, there was an epoch in Europe which congratulated itself on its application of reason and on its embrace of reason, and which was an age in which there was a lot of optimism about the scope of reason for improving life across all spheres of life. That reason was in many respects characterised by a belief in the efficacy of gathering data, experimentation, observation, empiricism, you might say, for the purposes of understanding the natural world and for the purposes of applying that understanding to practical problems, which in turn was giving rise to the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution and a massive increase in the productive forces of society and the economy. Part and parcel of this tendency was a generalised scepticism, a willingness to challenge authority, whether it's the authority of the ruling class, the authority of the clergy, and the authority of all kinds of figures who would do our thinking for us and demand some kind of obedience to themselves. We see this heading eventually in the French Revolution, and then the bloody aftermath of that revolution, and a slip back into despotism under Napoleon. We see Kant alert to those possibilities, that a revolution that didn't open the minds of people would be as susceptible to prejudice and despotism as that which it sought to replace. So this take on reason is one which sees the power of scepticism, one which calls for evidence, one which is suspicious of arbitrary authority, and one which values human flourishing. None of this occurred historically, as Kant points out, without a certain paradox, and Kant does use the term paradox, or without a certain tension between the possibilities that if people think for themselves that social cohesion might suffer. And we've already remarked that the Enlightenment was not without its dark side in slavery, colonisation, and so forth. And maybe even in its love affair with reason, that there was a certain disconnect with emotion, or as it was termed in the time, the sentiments or the passions, in favour of the cold light of reason. And this was a suspicion that was to give rise to what you call the romantic backlash in the early 19th century. I mean, a part of this was a disgust at the conditions of immiseration and hardship that arose for working people as a result of the capitalism, which went hand in hand with the Industrial Revolution. And this was William Blake's Dark Satanic Mills. I mean, Blake is a very interesting reaction to the so-called cold light of reason. For instance, he referred to Newton's work as Newton's sleep, because it was so dispassionate. Newton's sleep. And of course, Newton's sleep was the belief also that the universe was just a mechanism. And for Blake, it was peopled with spirits, animating spirits and angels and so forth. So there was a backlash there, and a re-establishment of the idea that the passions and the turbulence of the soul and the emotions and the sublime were to be valued, and that the cold light of reason needed to be at least moderated, if not even repudiated by the more extreme strands in the reaction against it. So I'm not one to paint it as something very easily characterisable, without paradoxes, without tensions. But at the same time, there are some clear ingredients in what the Age of Reason thought reason was. And we do live with the consequences. And we do, I would say, as a culture, buy into those particular clearly identifiable strands. In other words, a respect for evidence, scepticism about arbitrary authority, the virtue of thinking for oneself, and at least some kind of lip service to the idea that liberty is a good. I hope that was instructive, enjoyable. And thanks for listening. Thanks to patrons for bunging us a few quid. And if anybody else feels like making a $1 or $2 per month contribution, it does help us to pay for the space on the server. If we had a little bit more, we could perhaps put the odd video up. And there certainly is a facility for video conferencing, so we could do some live stuff as well, and dialogues and so forth. Coming soon, the next episode in this series will be on madness, or the loss of reason. If we are going to get a handle on reason, we need to examine what happens when there isn't any. I'm also still aware that there's a fourth episode of What is Fascism? Outstanding, and I'm working on that. We'll be continuing with our Lao Tzu series, and with our Interesting Times series, and with our Raw Thought series, which is for the patrons only. So plenty of stuff in the pipeline. And I think you can see that this series on reason opens up into the need to do some consideration of science. You know, what is science? What is the nature of its operation? What is the status of its knowledge claims? what is its usefulness, what are the problems with it, and so forth. In other words, this project opens up very clearly into a project I've had on the burner for some time, which is to deliver a few podcasts on the philosophy of science. You can also see from this historical take that I've just undertaken in these last two episodes on reason, that there is a need for some considerations of the nature of history, of the nature of historical claims, of their nature as truth claims or as interpretation. And there are many, many questions around history from the kind of philosophical stance where we could try and ask some basic questions. So that, again, I've got quite a lot of preparatory work on that. So there's tons of stuff in the pipeline. I hope you do keep listening and try and piece all this stuff together, because it does form a whole. It is all of a piece. It's rather like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, we're putting the pieces in. All of these themes relate, and relate quite closely. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks to patrons for helping us to keep this thing going. Look after yourselves, wash your hands, and do the various public health things, and make knowledge great again.